in a menacing way, thus performing the word rise in the title of the film in the sense of, you know, assuming an erect anthropomorphic position, and perhaps taking up arms in rebellion. And in fact, rising is something which the scene seems to encourage some of its viewers to do. In response to a version of this scene, this scene on YouTube, one viewer called Putz Forever observed that when he or she saw this moment in the cinema, quote, everyone stood up and clapped. So another sort of form of rising. However, I want to focus on a different, element in this scene, and I'm going to argue that Caesar's appearance as a political animal is more clearly signaled in this other element. Now, judging by YouTube comments alone, and we shouldn't make a habit of doing this, but you can learn something from everything, I think. According to other comments, particularly YouTube user Chessman 1177 wrote, in the cinema at this point there was complete shocked silence. There was the rapper rustlers, seat kickers, kids, all silent at this moment. Another user, ETSLB, put it this way, in the cinema I was, complete silence. I like how the grammatical forms the becoming sort of monument of frozen becoming architecture. But a third comment actually by G.A. Fong helps us pinpoint what people are responding to here. Fong says, at the pictures when he said no, everybody went quiet for a second and a few people going, what? Whoa, etc. So, when Caesar violently hits his human antagonist, audiences stand up and cheer. But when he says no, the initial response is a motionless, mute gaze. Such a gaze is, in fact, afforded by and anticipated in the film, in the scene itself, through a lingering sequence of close-up shots of the frozen, dumb, what the facial expressions of Dodge, the human being, plus two other onlookers. There's a gorilla and a second animal guard. Now, I do want to play this scene one more time just to give you a sense. Is it here? Here we go, it's here. Now we'll just skip forward a little bit. So now. So it goes on. Right. So now, if Rise of the Planet of the Apes has a moment of genius, I think it's this this 5-second sequence of close-up, mute, dumbstruck gazing in response to Caesar saying no. This slow caesura in the onslaught of action, which otherwise engulfs the film. And I'm not the only one to have noticed this. This moment in the film, these sort of few seconds, as this other edited version of the film, which I found on YouTube as well, demonstrates just very quickly. The rise.
No.
I should rest my argument there, right? That's the wow cat parody. Now, I propose to call this a look of wild surmise. So I'm just going to switch back to... Yeah, a look of wild surmise. And I borrow this phrase, wild surmise, from a sonnet titled "On First Looking into Chapman's Homer," written by John Keats, the English romantic poet, in 1816. The sonnet describes the transformative experience of reading the George Chapman translation of Homer's epic poems, and it ends with the following Homeric simile, in which the speaker compares the sensation occasioned by reading Homer to that of the Spanish conquistador Cortez when, for the first time, he saw the Pacific Ocean. Let's read this. "Then felt I, like stout Cortez, when with eagle eyes he stared at the Pacific. And all his men looked at each other with a wild surmise, silent upon a peak in Darien. Now these lines offer one of the finest expressions in English literature that I know of an aesthetic experience. Now normally an aesthetic experience is just, you know, an experience of something which you happen to find beautiful or sublime or picturesque or cute or sort of what are the words you want to use. What this simile emphasizes is that an aesthetic experience is an encounter between a subject and an object that challenges comprehension but provokes and prompts insecure speculation or conjecture. That's the wild surmise. Wild surmise names the experience of those who don't quite know what to make of what they're looking at. It's what the understanding and imagination do when they're overloaded, when one can only stare and, because one does not have the ideas or words adequate to the moment, be mute. Although, in fact, G.A. Fong's what, woa, etc. is also, I think, a natural sort of vocal response to this aesthetic experience. So to return to the scene from the film, I propose that the look of wild surmise in the face of Dodge and the spectators, and both in the cinema and in the scene itself, registers the moment that Caesar makes a claim to politics. Up until this point, Caesar has been, in the eyes of Dodge at least, an animal, but not a political animal, to invoke Aristotle's phrase. When Dodge issues his order, "Take your stinking paw off me, you damn dirty ape," he's not talking to Caesar, he's talking at him. Dodge is not directly addressing Caesar, he's rather employing the rhetorical figure of apostrophe, by which one calls out to entities we do not normally speak to, such as inanimate, dead, or even absent objects. In this case, it's an animal that, so far as Dodge knows, can neither understand nor speak language. So if this animal is putting up a fight, then it's, you know, for him it's merely as a piece of mute material or a mute matter sort of thwarting the inefficiencies of rational instrumentalization. So when Caesar says no, Dodge's mute gaze shows that he feels a little bit like Keats's Cortez. Just as Keats stares at the Pacific Ocean, Dodge stares at Caesar, much like he previously talked at him. Because, given what he's just heard, he's struggling to understand what it is he's looking at. It's important to note that these looks of wild surmise evince not total non-understanding, but rather they evince a struggle to understand, one which is marked by an understanding that one does not understand. But I think the important difference between Cortez and Dodge in this case is that whereas the Pacific Island Ocean rather is silent, Caesar talks back to Dodge. And given what Caesar says in response to Dodge, moreover, Dodge also understands that Caesar has understood him and what he said. So in other words, a thing with which he has had only a third-person relation via apostrophe has just called for a second-person relation via address, a sort of more direct I-you relationship. And it's at this interesting juncture of understanding and non-understanding when, you know, impossibly, miraculously, a thing begins to look like a person, that Dodge himself lost for words seems almost to look at Caesar's words. There's a sort of weird synesthetic effect here. Or look at Caesar's word, no. Dodge might be struck dumb, but his mute gaze and those of the onlookers eloquently expresses a confused subjective reaction to an event that cannot be subsumed under a concept, a possibility that should be impossible. A phenomenon that does not accord with an ordering of the world in which the animals we speak at do not reply to us. In Dodge's dumbstruck gaze is written something like the astonishment with which Edmund Burke, the so-called father of modern conservatism, experienced the French Revolution. Burke famously writes in The Reflections of the Revolution in France in 1790, "Everything seems out of nature in this strange chaos of levity and ferocity." Now, invoking, you know, the most important political revolution, history might seem to push my interpretation of this scene a little bit too far. And indeed, even though the film's tagline says evolution becomes revolution, I'm not even sure what that would mean. I'm not even sure what it means for a natural force like evolution to become a political event like revolution. We can talk about that later if you want. But I think the revolutionary nature of Caesar's response to... revolutionary nature of the response to Caesar's speech act becomes clear when we understand contemporary philosopher Jacques Rancière's thesis that democratic politics is the disruption and not the establishment of power's reality. Now, Rancière's term for power's reality is the partition of the sensible, a social organization of sensory perception that literally enables some beings to appear as persons while constraining others to appear as, by nature, just things. And in the history of political theory and practice, this distinction between persons and things is figured, Rancière observes, by the opposition between animals, or human beings with the capacity for speech, and animals with, at best, the capacity for non-linguistic vocalization. If, as Aristotle said in The Politics, human beings, or at least some of them, are political animals, this is because, as he also said in The Politics, they are, quote, animals capable of speech. Now, Rancière's provocative claim is that this opposition between animals with language and those without, quote, and I'm quoting from Rancière, is in no way the given upon which politics is based. It is, on the contrary, one of the stakes of the very dispute that institutes politics. So democratic politics happens, Rancière argues, when something disrupts the given partition of the sensible with its ordering of experience and makes those who seem to be animals appear to actually be political beings or political animals. Mm. And this, I want to suggest, is really the effect of Caesar's no. His speech disrupts his appearance in the order of things as a thing, because through the word no, he appears as a person and not as a thing. Now, of course, just saying no at the right moment doesn't in and of itself secure Caesar recognition as a person or a political animal. That recognition depends upon how people respond, whether or not they find his words meaningful. But at the least, I think we can say that Caesar's speech act has produced a now active fault line between the dominant partition of the sensible in which he appears as a thing and his disruptive appearance as a person. So what the look of wild surmise on the face of Dodge, what it sees and is fascinated by, is the simultaneity of and disjunction between his bodily existence as an animal and his appearance in language as a person. Another analogy I thought of was that it's like at this moment he's something like an image in a Rorschach test, you know, which tends to have sort of two potential, could be two different things. He's something like that, or he's perhaps he's like a Rorschach test which doesn't have two possible meanings, but could have one meaning, or it could just be a sort of flat material mark on a page. But I'm not quite sure about that analogy. Now, one reasonable question is, you know, is all this just fiction? Because in the real world, animals do not ordinarily say no. Or any other words, in American accents of English, or indeed in any human language. In the world of the film, Caesar the chimpanzee is able to speak only because his mother, who was subject to experiments at a pharmaceutical company, passed on to him a sort of biotechnologically enhanced intelligence. And in the eyes of Rancière and just about any other self-respecting political philosopher, the sheer fact that, you know, real-world animals cannot actually speak would disqualify them as candidates for political subjectivity. Mm-hmm. And indeed, Rancière has pretty clearly stated that non-humans, including animals, do not count as political subjects, couldn't count as political subjects, simply because the disruption of an established social order, which this is from, this is the moment of politics, in order for it to be political, and by definition politics is democratic, then it must be accompanied by the capacity and the desire to engage in reasoned discourse, in which, you know, animals supposedly cannot do, but human beings, or some of us at least, can do. Now, And vibrant matter, Jane Bennett suggests that Rancière's understanding of the implications of his own democratic theory from humans is inadequate. Her response is to argue that we need to, quote, loosen the tie between political participation and human language use. Unconstrained by human language use, she argues, democratic politics would thus be open to active participation from all kinds of material things and forces. And you know, if you know Bennett's sort of vital materialism, she imagines sort of a political ecology which includes trash, dead things, leaves, wind, proteins, you know, all kinds of things, human or not human. Now, as sympathetic as I am to Bennett's kind of materialist post-humanism, I think we can come up with a good response to Rancière without denying that politics, as the construction of just forms of living together in the world, ultimately gets articulated through language. And if this sounds like a kind of traditional position to take, then I would add that we can still maintain a link between politics and language without assuming that language is human in the first place. And this is something which we tend to do almost by default. On the one hand, we appreciate, you know, Judith Butler's point that the very materiality of bodies is discursively constructed, but we don't really think through the implications of the ways in which language itself is, as someone like Paul Demand says, marked by materiality so radical that it can be regarded as inhuman. But in any case, we can say that on the one hand, Rancière is perfectly correct when he says that, and this is a quote, politics exists because those who have no right to be counted as speaking beings make themselves, okay, of some account. And in doing so, such beings stage a contradiction in the moment, in one moment of two worlds, one world where their words matter politically, and one world where their words do not. On the other hand, it seems a mistake to assume, as Rancière does, that what those who interrupt the existing petition of the sensible are speaking about is always only themselves, their own claim to justice, their own position in the world. There's always the possibility that the one voicing the claim to politics is not the bearer of that claim. Even if the disruptive appearance of a thing as a person has to be articulated in words, such words, far from having to issue from the thing or person itself, can come from a speaking subject that is not the thing person. Animals with a capacity for speech might make politics possible, but this does not mean that only animals with capacity for speech can be political animals. And I'll just sort of just end by saying that this is kind of why I'm stressing that the most important thing about the scene from Rise of the Planet of the Apes is not Caesar's hitting dodge, not even his saying no, but rather the response to it. Because I think it shows that the initial, original emergence of any subject, any political subject, appears through this kind of confusing, almost kind of unintelligible kind of moment.